You're listening to classical music on West Virginia Public Broadcasting. That was The Light Cavalry Overture by Franz von Suppe, performed by the Montreal Orchestra and conducted by Charles Dutoit. I've got a couple of special guests here in the studio with us today. We have Maestro Grant Cooper of the West Virginia Symphony Orchestra and cellist Julian Schwartz with us too as well, who will be starring tomorrow night and with the Dvorak Cello Concerto. Say hi, everybody.
Hello, everyone.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about what we heard, Grant. Do you want to talk a little bit about the Light Cavalry Overture?
Yeah, I wanted to begin this season because it represents my 15th with the West Virginia Symphony Orchestra. I'm really honored to have been able to serve that long, and we've played so much wonderful literature over the period of time. And what struck me most about a 15th season was not so much that we should look back or forward with the season and recall certain pieces, but rather that we should celebrate the incredible variety of music that is available to us as a symphony orchestra. So here we have a program with Dvorak Cello Concerto, Beethoven's Seventh Symphony, two monuments of the repertoire, really, but also the overture you just heard by von Suppe, which represents Viennese operetta, and really kind of the birthplace of the modern symphony orchestra was Vienna and New York simultaneously. So the music that came out of the pit in Vienna was taken on by composers often to create larger works. And this particular piece is a perfect opener, I think, and hopefully our listeners enjoyed it a lot, and we'll come and hear the West Virginia Symphony Orchestra's interpretation of it tomorrow night.
Yeah, absolutely. That's tomorrow night at 8. And we'll also have Julian Schwartz, who's a young cellist and whose career is really taking off right now. And how old are you? You're only, 24, 25?
Yeah, 24 years old.
Wow, that's about my age. Nice to have some...
You're a young radio host.
Yeah. I know that your debut performance was with the Seattle Symphony at age 11, right?
Yes.
And what was that like? I mean, you must have been really young. Were you in over your head at all? Or?
Well, I was always, I still am, very ambitious. And I grew up with music in my house. My father's a conductor, and I come from a very musical family. And I always had some kind of pride in classical music and in wanting to become as good and as knowledgeable about it as possible. From an early age, I had my sights set on becoming a cello soloist. And since then, I've really tried to make that happen because I love the cello. I think it's a wonderful instrument, and I love having my own voice and being able to bring music to an audience, hopefully a large appreciative audience, because music has touched me in my own life so much. So at that young age, I guess ignorance is bliss. I didn't really know that you should get nervous or that you should have any preconceived notion of what it is to be a performing musician. So I just went out there and did what I did and sort of with abandon. And of course, since then, I've had to make sure that my enthusiasm goes in check because there are various technical demands of the instrument that is very, you know, a difficult instrument. But in the end, it's all about the music making. And once I realized that that is the point, that it's not about the abandon, it's not about the fame, it's about making great music, then I was able to really devote myself to my childhood dream, which is still my dream.
Right. So you said you'd always wanted to be a cello soloist. Any reason why the cello? Any reason why it fascinated you?
Well, to tell you the truth, the double bass fascinated me much more than the cello because I was a five-year-old kid seeing a double bass and it was
amazing.
Enormous
yeah.
and seemed very cool to me, or masculine, I don't know, something about it. And my parents urged me to play the cello. And I guess it only took me a couple years to realize that they were right. Not that the bass is not a great instrument, but the cello has many more solo opportunities. And since then, I thought of myself in some ways. I said I wanted to be a cello soloist. I really just wanted to be some kind of singer. So what we're doing as instrumentalists in general, and Maestro Cooper can attest to this, I'm sure, as being a trumpet player, is that you're trying to mimic the human voice. You're trying to give the human voice a new timbre, and that's what instrumental playing is. And the cello was my way and it still is, my way to sing and my way to express my innermost musical voice and interpretation. So, yes.
Yeah, absolutely. And so that debut concert, you talked about your father. Well, the conductor of that debut concert just happened to be someone we're familiar with here, our audience, because we've had him on our show, and that was Gerard Schwartz, Julian Schwartz's father. He is the former conductor of the Seattle Symphony and now the conductor of the All-Star Orchestra, and he's actually conducted the West Virginia Symphony Orchestra last year. So was it like nerve-wracking at all that if you messed up a note, you might have to hear about it at home later that night?
Well, that's interesting you mentioned that, because growing up with a musical family, especially a well-known musician as a father, there was always something about it that I was a little bit nervous to get his feedback or his criticism. That said, he's still my father, you know, so I was always, to this day, I'm more comfortable playing for him than others, yet in some ways I am slightly more nervous playing for him than others. It's an interesting balance, yeah, between playing for him as a musician or as a son, but I really wasn't nervous at all. And I, to this day, I don't get nervous before a little anxious during the day, sure, mm-hmm, or making sure that I prepare as adequately as, sure, I need to. Yeah. But in terms of nerves, I feel when I get on stage is actually when I become the least nervous.
Wow, that's great. Yeah, yeah, you feel really in control, I'm sure.
Yes.
And I know you've premiered music and you're a fan of new music, and you premiered at the Eastern Music Festival in Greensboro. And I know Maestro Cooper is a big part of that as a regular conductor. Is that where this collaboration may have started?
The collaboration between me and Maestro Cooper started, yes, at the Eastern Music Festival, because that was the first chance he had to hear me. This past summer, we performed the Elgar Cello Concerto together with an orchestra there, and for me, working with him was just an amazing treat. He's a maestro of the finest order, mm-hmm, and everyone in West Virginia is so lucky to have him as their artistic or musical leader.
Yeah,
and especially for an orchestra to have a consistent artistic vision over a long period of time, that's what the music world, I think, needs, and they need people to take the reins in every community, and to see what he has done in West Virginia is inspiring. But that enthusiasm and that great love for the art translated into our collaboration with the Elgar Concerto, and to be able to play a great staple, perhaps the most famous piece of music ever written for the cello, the Dvorak Concerto, with him in West Virginia is a great honor for me.
Yeah, and you're right. We've had a very consistent vision throughout the 15 years of Maestro Grant Cooper's tenure here. Do you want to talk about Maestro Cooper? Do you want to talk about anything about this year that makes this year special?
Well, just as I was referring to earlier, that it's an opportunity to celebrate the incredible diversity of music that we have. Three real staple pieces here to open the season for sure. But in October, a program of miniatures, even though we think of the orchestra as a large number of musicians, which of course it is, it's often used by composers in much smaller ensembles.
True.
We even have a piece that has no strings in it on the next program, for example, by
Rinaldo
Hahn, which I think is a first for us, maybe. But it enables us to explore composers who are looking back at earlier music. So that piece is there, Ravel's Tombeau de Couperin is on that program as well. Respighi, The Birds, all pieces that actually quote, if not directly, the earlier Renaissance, mm-hmm, style and Baroque musical forms. So we have that celebration going on, including the last concert, which is going to be in May, where the program is not being divulged. It's being called my dream concert. And I can tell you that the programming for that concert is evolving in my mind even as we speak.
Yeah.
And I really want it to be a concert that represents a summation, really, of the incredible joy that it's been to make music with these wonderful musicians over 15 years.
So that concert isn't set yet. Is that what you're saying?
It's being called Maestro's Dream or something like that. I forget what the exact term is in the marketing.
Or something.
Yeah. But no, we have not published the repertoire,
wow,
because we're still allowing it to evolve.
That's great.
Why don't we have Julian take up his cello here and show us a little bit about the Dvorak Concerto. Take us kind of...
My pleasure.
Yeah. Go and get set up while I'll cover you for you a few minutes.
Yeah, go ahead and talk about this cello concerto a little bit while Julian gets set up here.
Well, one of the main things that came out of a humanities talk that we just gave a couple of hours ago is the acknowledgement that the cello has not enjoyed the straight lineage of ascendancy as a solo instrument that, say, the piano and the violin have. We go back to Haydn. We have two concertos by Haydn for the cello, but then nothing. We don't have a concerto by Beethoven, and we don't have a concerto by Mendelssohn. But there's one by Schumann about 1850, and one by Saint-Saëns about 1873 or so. And then Tchaikovsky's Rococo Variations and the Dvorak Concerto right at the end of the 19th century. So really there are about four major works in an entire 100 years of music history with composers like Beethoven and Brahms not writing concertos. And that is in part, I think, because the instrument itself has very specialized needs in terms of being accompanied by an orchestra, because it is basically a middle register instrument, a tenor voice, if you will, mm-hmm. of the string section. It's a lot harder for that to project through an orchestra. So one of the biggest challenges that a composer has is in writing for the cello in a characteristic way while still being able to give the orchestra something meaningful to do. So, Julian, maybe you could start off. Do you want to comment on that, or maybe start off with the first theme? And
yes, I'd love to start off with the first theme of the piece. It's really, in some ways, the cello is the hero in this piece. I don't want to sound too heroic about it, but the cello, it's a piece in B minor, in a minor key, and it opens with somewhat ominous, almost funeralistic music. And then over the long orchestral introduction, then the cello comes in the B major. And it's just an amazing moment. And throughout the piece, really, the cello is the heroic voice. I think it's a very striking opening. Let me...
Okay, yeah, Julian Schwartz performing live.
Opening. And one thing that we often notice with Dvorak is that he has an incredible sense of melodic gift, I think. It's one of the things that really makes his music stand out, more so than many classical composers, and composers like Beethoven and Brahms almost eschewed the idea of a melodic beauty because it would take away from the structural integrity of the music, I think. Of course, we have the other opposite end of that is Tchaikovsky, who wrote such incredibly beautiful melodies, and they're so beautiful that you just want to hear them again, and that's often what Tchaikovsky gives us, of course. but maybe a more lyrical passage for a second contrasting theme here.
This is the second theme originally uttered by the horn, and though I've somewhat always wanted to be a horn player, I try to one-up the horn player in my statement of the second theme. So
okay.
The second theme.
Thank you.
So Dvorak is using a real classical approach to creating structure in music, and that the materials contrast directly with themselves, and this gives him a lot of a platform, as it were, to work off of. He uses these materials, and we start to recognize elements of them as the music develops, right? That there are some other places in the first movement, I'm even thinking of the way the movement ends, perhaps, but ways where this material kind of culminates or comes together. Can you think of something, Julian, you could play?
Well, I find it interesting that in the development section, Dvorak elaborates on the opening theme, but in a very melodic way. I'll play just a couple bars and then maybe a little bit of the coda.
Yeah, so we could hear, hopefully we could hear the same melodic content as at the beginning. And let's play that one more time. So here's the... And here's the development of it. It's quite remarkable, really,
really
the way this transforms.
Stretches out that theme so long. Yeah.
But that's what gives coherency to the music, that structure that we're able to, even if we don't grab a hold of, oh, there's the first theme slowed way down, we somehow understand that it's the same cloth this music is being cut from.
All part of the same piece.
Mm-hmm. And then maybe a bit of the coda, just so we have a nice virtuosic end
to the movement.
Fabulous.
Yeah, absolutely great. Unfortunately, you can't see it on radio, but he's really up way high on the fingerboard there, and just playing really high notes. And these double stops, too, are really sounding out really great. Excellent work.
Yeah, so the second movement needs to contrast again, and I guess we'd, in a general characterization, we'd say that the first movement is a fast movement or a quick movement. So the second movement contrasts in key as well as in general character. Nice introduction for the winds of the orchestra, and especially the clarinet plays a really big role, and I think that's one of Dvorak's keys in creating the right balanced texture for the cello. He doesn't write so much for the oboe solo as he does for the clarinet solo, because it's a gentler quality of sound and more easily able to be matched by the cello. But maybe, Julian, play a little opening of your theme when you take it from the woodwinds. Then what happens?
Well, then Dvorak quotes one of his songs. And something interesting to note about this concerto, this great concerto, is that he had fallen in love 30 years earlier with a woman named Josefina, who was the older sister to his eventual wife named Anna. And during the sketching and writing of this great piece, Dvorak got word that she was very ill back in Bohemia, and he actually added a couple quotes, one in the end of the last movement and one in the second movement, of her favorite songs, as well as elongating the coda of the last movement very much so, to almost as an elegy or a memorial to her after he returned to the Czech Republic and after a month of being back, she had passed. So This is a quote from one of her favorite songs, translated as "Leave Me Alone."
Yeah. It's beautiful, yeah.
Isn't really it? Heartfelt there. Beautiful music right there.
Yes. And the one of my favorite moments of this whole piece is a horn trio that happens in also the second movement, which quotes the opening material. And then Dvorak aims to have the cello be its own horn trio. So this is a little bit of a what he calls a quasi-cadenza, which is in three parts for the cello alone.
All three parts there played on one instrument. Four strings you've got, fortunately. And I guess four fingers to play with. But it's neat. And there were times there where you were playing with the bow, but you were also using fingers plucked. Of your left hand to pluck.
How did you do that? So he plucks while trying to...
This technique is called a left-hand pizzicato, and one of the first people to champion it was the great violin virtuoso Niccolo Paganini. And basically using the other fingers of your left hand that aren't used to play the note that you're using, that you're producing with the sound with the bow, and use those extra fingers to pluck other notes on the instrument on different strings. So that's what Dvorak employs in this quasi-cadenza.
So it sounds like there's multiple instruments, not just one guy playing, even though you're playing several parts at the same time.
So anyway, this is a really monumental work, and I hope everyone has a chance to hear it tomorrow night.
Well, maybe a little bit of the last movement before you
hit the score. Oh, sure. I'll play the opening theme of the last movement, which is almost some type of march, right?
Yeah, a steady march.
Steady Bohemian march.
Then there's a variation on that. It's kind of a B section.
And so forth.
Yeah. Well, fabulous. Well, it's going to be a great performance, I think. The orchestra rehearses with Julian tonight and tomorrow morning in a dress rehearsal, and gives the concert at 8 o'clock on Saturday at the Clare Center. At 7 o'clock, Julian and I will be speaking more about the music and his personal relationship to it. So
they with a pre-concert talk, right?
Pre-concert talk, right?
And I hear there's champagne involved at some point.
There is. I believe that this 15th anniversary season is going to be toasted at 7:40 in the lobby. Free champagne. Bring your thirst. Absolutely.
That's right. Well, we'll toast to 15 years of Maestro Cooper. That's great. And thank you, Julian, for giving us a little preview of that.
It's my pleasure. I can't wait to rehearse with the orchestra this evening.
Yeah. Everybody listening right now has to imagine what the orchestra, you know, what the accompanying parts are. But Dvorak does a great job of balancing the orchestra with the cello and making sure the orchestration is fits perfectly together, and no one's competing, but everybody still is heard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Great piece. Probably the most famous cello concerto, I think, in the repertoire. Julian, would you agree?
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. Fitting for an opening night.
Great, yeah.
And Beethoven's Seventh Symphony is the other piece on the program. That will be the piece right before intermission. if you're listening to the radio, you get to know that the concerto will be the second half of the program.
Mm-hmm.
So the Beethoven Seventh Symphony is an amazing piece because it is almost all about rhythm and an excitement, a frenzy almost, that Beethoven is able to evoke through his use of quite simple materials. And that's, of course, a hallmark of Beethoven's style, that the materials themselves are not remarkable individually. They're not, as we said before, like Tchaikovsky, who writes these really beautiful melodic materials. They're simply just scales and arpeggios. And yet Beethoven has a way with these materials unmatched by any composer ever since. And you've got a little bit, I think, you could spin on a disc here, give the audience a bit of an idea of the grandeur that exists in the opening of the piece. The piece is in A major, which is typically a key associated with splendor.
Mm-hmm.
And yet he really goes to quite distant keys, especially C major and F major, and we don't normally expect A major music to go to those keys.
Especially in the first movement.
And, well, he has entire movements in those keys. He's got an A minor movement, of course, and he's got an F major movement for the scherzo. But long passages, which are in C major, which is a distantly related, if related at all, key to A major, but Beethoven makes it work. And he goes through all of these keys in this introduction, so it's like he's encapsulating his entire tonal spectrum in the one introduction, and it's easily the longest introduction that Beethoven ever wrote, so much so that you can almost accept that it's almost like it's going to be the movement.
Wow.
But then it turns into this bum-ba-dum-bum-ba-dum rhythmical dance motive, which is repeated over and over again. So maybe let's spin through the introduction and get into the opening allegro, and then we'll come back.
Yeah, absolutely. Beethoven's Symphony No. 7, the first movement. This is the Concertgebow, and conducted by Bernard Haitink.
Thank you.
So there we have that huge introduction. Like I said, just key centers and scales, creating an enormous sense of expectation. And the very simplest bump, bump, bump.
Yeah, it fades out into almost nothing.
And almost dries up, doesn't it?
Yeah, it dries up, and you just hear almost the basic semblance of rhythm before you start getting the activity of melodic activity and harmonic activity.
Yeah. Yeah, and yet we're always struck when we listen to Beethoven's music about how monumental it is, and when we really listen to it, we realize it's made up of very, very pungent but simple ideas.
Right, yeah, and definitely expanding on some of the forms of the day and doing some interesting things that are unusual for the time.
Yep, he really expanded the idea of the classical symphony, even though he used the same model, slow introduction and Allegro first movement.
Mm-hmm.
Then a set of variations, really. I think the second movement,
right.
The great A minor movement, again, just made up of the simple idea of a long, short, short, long, 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 short, short, long, mm-hmm. long, rhythmic motif. I'd love us if we could play a little bit of that track, and love it if we could, just so we can hear again how this building of tension is achieved through relatively simple means.
Yeah, right? with wonderful rhythmic undulation here. Constant building there from the smallest of rhythmic units into what just keeps coming and coming and doesn't stop.
Yeah.
Also, I love that first opening chord. It's just a normal minor chord, but it's inverted.
So second inversion. That's right. It's got the fifth of the chord is on the bottom, and that creates a sense of instability.
Right.
In the chord, even more so than straight A minor would.
Right.
And he actually ends the movement on exactly the same voicing of the chord. So we had special attention paid to that last night in rehearsal because Luke Seiler, our second horn player, has that low E.
Oh, yeah.
And
so
making
he's
sure that he understands that he's on the bass of it, right?
Yeah.
It's a staggering example, actually, of how important voicing in chords can be.
It really can change the entire color of the chord.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So the third movement, this is, I believe, in F major, is a scherzo, and it's much more complicated than it appears on the surface, and particularly about the way Beethoven groups his rhythmical units. The music's in one, 1-2-3, 1-2-3, 1-2-3, 1-2-3, this way, but the number of bars that consist within each unit, sometimes it's two, sometimes it's three, sometimes it's just one, oftentimes it's four, but when he breaks that pattern of four, we really feel it as an expressive awakening kind of thing in the music. So here's the third movement. Yeah, so a fantastic middle section ensues, and then a very interesting feature of this movement is that Beethoven doesn't ask you to go back to the beginning and repeat what you've just played. He does repeat the music, but he writes it out so that he can actually have a different dynamic scheme. So his great outbursts of fortes at the beginning that shock us even more the second time round, because he goes the other way with them, and instead of being suddenly louder, they're suddenly softer, and it takes a lot of control by the part of the orchestra to maintain the sense of it rhythmic intensity while still playing very, very softly. Mm-hmm. But it's a masterstroke, and on the page it's really marvelous, and it's one of the challenges in realizing the piece. And then to the last movement, which is just a, man, talk about frenzy.
Yeah, absolutely.
Just a really barreling forward at all times. There's one shocking moment after the exposition is repeated where he holds the notes out a little bit longer. I don't know if we've got time to get to that, actually, but let's roll some of this so people can get a sense of just what power there is in this music. there it was. He actually didn't take the repeat, so we got to the moment where he holds out those notes. But how amazing that moment is too, that just holding those out, completely breaking this perpetual motion mold that he set up. But you can tell that simple figure has got such potential in Beethoven's plan, hands, and that's really the genius of his music, I think, that he wrings from such simple materials, such deep musical effects, and probably is one of the reasons why his music stands the test of time so well. It's because the materials don't have any pretension about them.
Yeah, very simple, but the building blocks are simple, but he makes these masterpiece of buildings out of them.
Yeah.
And takes them through great development and interesting ideas. Beethoven's 7th coming up tomorrow night, and that's with the West Virginia Symphony Orchestra, opening night 2015, tomorrow night at the Clay Center with Julian Schwartz. Julian, thank you for coming on today.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
One thing I wanted to mention to the audience is that cello you heard, that's actually from 1743. Do you want to talk about that for like 20 seconds?
No, we were just talking about it right before we went on. As you know, we're talking about the history of music and what was happening at this time. And it was, you know, this cello was made before Beethoven was even born. So music has so much relevance, and it's something so old but can be so fresh, because there are many, many people in the world who have never heard the Beethoven 7th Symphony before. And that's one of the many reasons that everyone should come tomorrow night and hear this great music.
Yeah, absolutely. Maestro Cooper, any last words?
See you at the concert.
That's right. We'll see you there. The opening night, tomorrow night. Come see it.